Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.
Hi, I'm Adam.
And I'm Sabine. Welcome to the 15th episode of Robots.
In the spirit of the holiday season, today's episode is all about robots as toys. We speak to Mark Tilden, robot designer at Huawei Robotics, about designing robots for children and what he thinks that scientists and researchers can learn from the toy industry.
Afterwards, don't miss our Christmas contest entitled, Guess What Our Newly Received Huawei Femi Sapiens Did During Her First Weekend in Switzerland, for a chance to find one under your Christmas tree.
But first, here's Christine with the news.
Thanks, Adam. In time for the festive season, robot actors, dancers, and performers around the world have prepared their own contributions. At the Mottoman Robotic Lab at the University of Dayton, dancing robots have been secretly rehearsing a ballet performance to the dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Osaka University has hosted one of Japan's first robot-human theater productions, with robots specially programmed to speak lines with human actors and move around the stage with them. Finally, Taiwan's University of Science and Technology has announced a special performance of The Phantom of the Opera on December 27th, in which the two leads will be played by robots. If you have cable, you might be able to tune in to a new robot show called Japan, Robot Nation. The documentary highlights how Japan is sitting on a demographic time bomb. It has the highest proportion of senior citizens in the world, almost no net immigration, and birth rates are plummeting. The future trend of the current net population loss is so bad that within the next 100 years, Japan is forecast to lose two-thirds of its population. The show discusses how the country with the world's second-largest economy plans to use robots as a unique solution to its unique crisis. For links and videos for all the robot actors, dancers, and performers, a web version of the Japan Robot Nation show, and a list of our favorite last-minute robot Christmas presents, as well as other recommendations for the holiday season around the web, visit www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Mark Tilden is a true robotics lover, having built thousands of robots of all shapes and sizes in the last few decades. After pioneering Beam Robotics at the University of Waterloo in Canada,
which incidentally is where I went to university,
Tilden then moved south to the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. A perpetual tinkerer, Tilden's research eventually evolved into toy design when he was hired as a consultant for Huawei Robotics in Hong Kong. He's the designer of some of their most famous toys that sell in the millions, such as the RoboSapiens or the RoboRaptor. A full biography, however, would take up this whole podcast, so let's go straight to the interview.
Hi, I'm Mark Tilden. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
How do you do?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you doing?
Not so bad. It's a nice, bright, sunny day here in Hong Kong.
Very nice. Can you introduce yourself maybe to our listeners? Tell us what kind of work you do.
Okay, my name is Mark Tilden. I'm a mild-mannered mad scientist, basically into world domination at about 14 inches high. Over the past 7 years, I've put out about 20 million robots onto an unsuspecting mass populace, not one of which has actually ever kidnapped a beautiful lab assistant, although we have tried.
Very nice. Tell us a little bit about these robots.
Well, they're based upon a robot technology that I invented called Biomorphics back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when I was a scientist for a national laboratory, Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Basically, my philosophy has always been there must be a way to optimize performance-to-silicon ratios in robots so that we can stop building these really expensive things that always break when they fall down. Because those of us who have actually built real robots realize that deacceleration, trauma, and concrete poisoning is what's keeping robots from really entering the mass scene. And one of the things that I've done is that with Beam Robotics, and that's now an international concern, I found a simple and elegant way of basically building robots that as soon as you turn them on, they figure themselves out. And then we take that up to China, and we produce a huge number of them. The nice thing was is that when I built things for science, it was $1 million to produce one unit. In toys, they give you $1 for building 1 million units. But at the end of the day, if you actually sell something, you tend to make a rather interesting point.
Okay, so maybe tell us a bit more about your philosophy to approach it to designing these robots.
It basically started back in the 1980s. I've been building robots. I'm a compulsive robot builder and have been since I was 3. But primarily, I've gotten very frustrated with an awful lot of the development of robotics in that a lot of people seem to think the Asimovian ideal of coming up with a super machine or super brain and then the body would happen later, unfortunately, just doesn't seem to work out very well. On the other hand, if you look at Mother Nature, you'll see that she concentrates more on building better bodies and then a mind eventually happens later. And you have to take a look at, you know, like 20 million extant species on the planet, not one of which, only one of which actually thinks that paying taxes is a good idea. And so the whole idea was to try a different approach to conventional sort of top-down robot philosophy, the bottom-up philosophy taken from a brand new angle, and that is through Lamarckian evolution. So the real problem with most roboticists is that they build one robot and it was hard and it doesn't work anywhere near as they want, and so they then stop. But then I thought, well, why not try to evolve robots from a lesser state to a higher state and see how far we can get with the evolution? Most people thought I was crazy and that it would take, you know, like 3.5 billion years, just like Mother Nature did. But I had one advantage, and that is that I kept my paperwork. And so I went from single-celled robotic organisms to fully self-contained autonomous female humanoids in just a little under 20 years. And that was actually a rather interesting approach, and so far it hasn't been duplicated, judging by how little competition we have.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think scientists, after seeing you do these things for 20 years, don't want to move towards your way of building robotics?
Because those of us who have the blessed Frankenstein complex don't want to play with anybody else's toys. We want to play with our own. And the fact is that I can really understand that in a lot of different ways. One of the things that, for example, I find extremely frustrating is that because we keep on seeing the same robots repeated, you know, like decade after decade and never getting quite close to the ideals that we have seen in science fiction, what happens is that people just basically restart from zero all the time. And this is fine. I mean, what's interesting, though, is that in the recent years, computers have essentially taken away an awful lot of the building acumen that essentially was so powerful during the middle of the 20th century. I, for example, I think call myself the last of the Hewlett-Packard generation, and that is that I'm, you know, give me a pile of junk and I'll give you a machine at the end of it. But so few people do that now. They basically say, hey, great, I'll whip up a simulation, post it on YouTube, and that's just as good as real life. The problem with, of course, a computer-based robot is that it's not going to clean your floors or do your dishes very well. One of the things that I basically realized a long time ago is that you just can't change people's minds about how they want to approach their own particular sort of technique. And let's face it, a computer with a massive brain basically seems to have a lot of the attributes that might basically fulfill the science fiction dreams that Asimov and various other sort of geniuses have postulated over the years. But from straight experience and exposure, nobody's ever sat down in front of a machine and basically come up with a copy of a human mind that would actually be worth a damn. If there is, then, you know, somebody send me an email because I'd love to see. On the other hand, you know, the original RoboSapien basically ran across a table on 28 transistors based upon the analog control technology of my own design. That sort of performance to silicon ratio just basically results in something that can be moved forward. And this is something which is a real problem because there are some incredible geniuses out there, but the problem with a lot of the things that they invent, I'm not going to look at anybody in any particular area, but putting the resources of an entire company around one product that unfortunately is not able to move forward to the next logical step, which is, can you make it cheaper? That basically is something which I think keeps scientific robots down, but basically has been an incredible boon for me in the toy industry. One of the things that's really nice is that if you come up with a simple, elegant solution for people in the toy industry, they don't give a damn how it works, only that it does, and that it's cheap enough for you to basically put on the shelves.
So let's speak a little bit about the toy industry. You've been working for Huawei for a number of years now, I guess.
That's right.
Can you tell us a bit about your experience? Maybe, first of all, why did you go to designing toys from designing scientific robots? Why is this industry more interesting? And also why you guys are so good at it, and there's nobody else who seems to come out with as many new robots as Huawei seems to come up with.
Well, to answer your last question first, the bottom line is that we're just a bunch of guys who like to build toys for our own interest. That's one of the few things that we can actually do here at Huawei, which is fairly different from other toy companies, which most other toy companies are market-driven, you know, like, Billy Ray Cyrus, or they look at some other sort of new super toy, or Tickle Me Elmo. Whereas here at Huawei, if we come up with a great idea and something that we want to build, then what we can do is we can show it to our prototype to our bosses, and if our bosses say, hooray, then all of a sudden we're off building. That's actually quite an advantage, and one of the major things that is fairly unique about the Huawei structure. I do consulting for a variety of other toy companies and still scientific concerns, but it's just nice to have a sort of a wild sort of robot cowboy mentality, which basically allows us to try things that would otherwise never go anywhere else. In terms of my actual history, what happened was is that I was a scientist at Los Alamos National Labs. I was the robotics department there for 10 years. And then a couple of interesting things happened. They crashed my robot on Mars. Al Gore failed to become president of the United States. A lot of funding got canceled. And then, of course, 9/11. And so as a Canadian scientist working for the Americans, I basically decided, you know, to branch out from academia. I looked around at a variety of other things, and as I said, I still do consulting in a variety of different sort of organizations. But the toy industry was just fun. Surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is that I was just so impressed, because you got to remember, at NASA, right, 10 years is what they consider a rush job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what was really funny was that the very year that I joined Huawei, which is 2001, I remember spending 6 weeks trying to show these people at JPL that I had this autonomous analog-based walking robot for Mars exploration that was amazing, and it was pages and pages of papers and publications and proposals and exhibitions and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Brought the same robot over here to Hong Kong, showed this guy, he looked at it. 2 seconds later, he said, great, I'll give you $1 million to build 1 million of them.
Nice.
And you suddenly realize, that was easy. And what happened then, of course, was the fantastic exploration, because getting the approval to proceed is one thing. Getting to understand and translate your technology into Chinese, that's hard. And then, of course, coming up with something that you never face in the academic industry, which is not producing one, but producing 1 million, and then producing 1 million that are not only inexpensive, but safe and fun. You see, one of the things that most people don't realize, and one of the things that I've done is I've gone around and I've talked to an awful lot of my former colleagues and said, hi, remember that great stuff we used to talk about? We got some guys here who basically look into it. Well, there's two major problems. One is that when you take a robot and turn it into a toy, you've essentially trivialized it in a very large way, and that can have a sort of impact on people's academic sense of self-worth. The other real problem is that we have a tendency as scientists to think that the technology is everything. But what I learned very early on in the game is that you hide the technology. Technology is transparent. The fact that the robot walks is completely irrelevant. Of course it has to walk. I mean, like every cartoon robot walks, so therefore this robot has to walk as well. Making something which can move fast, efficiently, and has all these other sort of technological aspects in it is nothing compared to the fact of, does it fart in a way that makes my brother laugh? And these are, of course, the specs that are very necessary. When you are building a toy, you are basically trying to key on somebody's imaginative interest And they will only go to the technology if you get them so enamored with it that they will actually take a screwdriver to the item. To this end, I've actually made all of my items so that you can, in fact, completely dismantle them with a single screwdriver. The PCBs inside are completely labeled. All the wires are color-coded. Complete schematics are available online. And they even have incredible numbers of hidden features for the budding roboticist out there. See, one of the things that I found being an analog bottom-up roboticist, and during the 1990s, I was literally building a robot a day. If you want to see them, there are museums all around the world and probably buried with the Lost Ark of the Covenant in Area 51, as far as I know. But the thing was is that what was awful was you suddenly realize that it is easier to change the laws of physics than it is to change a lot of scientists' minds. And what you have to do is come up with some other compelling reason. And the reason that I came up with was don't try and corrupt the scientists. Corrupt their children. And what was interesting is that the original robots that I came out with, again, they were just toy experiments to try and see if I could come up with controllers and motors and systems that were not being made with NASA-grade technology, but all of a sudden toy-grade technology. And this is sort of like those science fictions, alternate history of science fictions. If you were all of a sudden put into, say, a 1980s American factory, knowing what you know today, what industry would you start? Well, that's exactly what it's like to basically go up to one of my factories in China right now, even to the point where there's disco music basically playing out of the radios, you know, like Copacabana in the original Chinese is actually very interesting. But that's the sort of interest. I mean, it's an interesting question. When you have to start looking at industries, you're looking at cost and production. The first RoboSapien assembly line that I basically did, I mean, this is one thing. Building the toy prototype, well, that was 2 weeks of fun. The science for that was, of course, like 10 years prior, but he actually ran on only 28 transistors. But the end result, which was a one-acre factory floor, and parts came in and finished robots came out every 33 seconds, that's the trick. Right?
That's impressive. I mean,
it gets down to that rather interesting definition of life. You know, like, is something alive when it basically sort of like it stands up and is capable of automatic interaction, or is it only alive when it is capable of reproduction? When the factory started kicking that out, that was one thing. And originally, with the original RoboSapien, I thought that we might sell maybe 50,000 to a couple of academics. 7 million robots later, I guess we managed to get something right on a much more visceral plane, and that, of course, was one of the more interesting object lessons that I've had working in the toy industry.
So, Mark, can you tell us a little bit about the FemiSapien, your latest robot that you designed?
Well, yeah. What's interesting, though, is that, as I said, the evolution of biomorphic robotics from the very first single-celled organisms, which you can still buy online from solarbotics.com, all the way up to RoboSapien, who was a bit of a gorilla. And since then, I've built dinosaurs, horses, the RS2, which is a giant walking robot that can get up, get down. We built robot snakes. We built walking spiders. But the thing was is that for the first time, I was finally able to go back to the classic set point control that is typically used for conventional robot mechanisms, you know, the sort of things that you might get in Japanese and, of course, high-end research stores. That is things where robots which are based entirely upon servos, which are very expensive. Now, the thing is that I didn't want to go to the classic, you know, 24 to 48 motor design that you might find inside the Japanese robots. I basically had an interesting question, which is, what is the smallest number of motors that would allow you to build a fully competent working humanoid? And the answer turned out to be 5 motors, and basically I was able to use those 5 motors in a mechanical way that mimicked female locomotion, actuation, and abilities. And what we wanted to do with FemiSapien was show that since the very simian RoboSapien 5 years ago, our technology has advanced. Biomorphics technology is now to the point where we can do in 5 motors, very inexpensively, what other people can't do in a lot of other motors, and with a lot less cost, and, of course, make something that basically is both enigmatic and fun. And, of course, there was another secret motion, which was I seem to have built lots of boys' toys over the past little while. I wanted to take my hand at actually trying to build something for girls. And that's what FemiSapien was all about.
That's interesting you say that, because I was in the store in London the other day, and I noticed it was one of the biggest, I think they were the biggest toy store in all of London. And I went to the girls' floor, and it was a bunch of pink dolls and Barbies and stuff. And then I went to the boys' floor, and it was, I think half the floor was covered in robots. And I think they were actually, most of them were Huawei robots.
Well, mine.
So I'm wondering, I find it really interesting that you're making this robot that's more or less meant for girls. Do you think that you can interest girls in robotics, maybe in the future by bringing out more products, or is it more of a boys type of technology?
Well, I have a philosophy, and that is that no technology becomes successful until it interests the female of the species. And that is, you know, take a look at it. Take a look at everything from airplanes to cars to cell phones. Only when it goes through its initial phase and actually becomes something which is a simple, elegant, and reliable utility does it wind up basically getting the interest of the dominant control species on the planet, which is the evolution of the high-heeled shoe. And the thing was is that this is the well, – this it sounds facetious, but the bottom line is that as a scientist, you basically think about the technology, but as a businessman – you have to think, what is it going to be that you can put into your item so that it interests everybody? And half the people on the planet are female, and they're the ones who keep technology for a longer period of time, rather than, you know, like boys, which basically was like, you know, play with something and then just put it into a bottom shelf for a long while. The thing was is that you have to basically put on your business hat, and the FemiSapien was an experiment, nothing more, to see whether or not we could make something that had the appropriate elegance to basically pull in that sort of appeal. The fact is that it's been fairly interesting. Marketing has actually been a bit of a problem with it. There's been an awful lot of changes in the business world over the past year, and so she hasn't done anywhere near as well as we'd hoped. But we had one rather interesting little spec. We sold 15,000 in Japan, and we only had 9 returned.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting spec. I mean, when you sell something, you typically get a 5% return on pretty much anything, you know, because of buyer's remorse or something. But that's a return rate which basically says that people bought her not because they thought that she was, you know, something cute, but because they really wanted her for either the way she looked or the way she moved or, well, we don't know. I mean, what's very interesting is that a toy is a very personal item, and how somebody plays with it or why, well, we just don't have any way of actually getting a measure on that. And this is what's so interesting about our particular market as well, because we don't know what it is. Like, I know an awful lot of what my scientist colleagues and stuff like that like, but what does a young child want? And you can read a million books, but the bottom line is the best thing you can do is build something that interests you and then see how far it will actually go in the marketplace. And we've had some incredible successes, but we've also had some rather interesting failures. FemiSapien, I hope, will carry on for another year. One of the things that I loved, I really liked last year, 2007, I built true robots. That is, robots, the RoboBoa, and which was our snake, and the RoboQuad, which was our four-legged spider, which were completely non-biologically inspired. That is that there is nothing on the planet that basically moves like them or basically responds to them. They were completely novel evolutionary products. Unfortunately, nobody knew what they were. So they sold okay, but they didn't sell anywhere near as well as I'd hoped. I'm still very proud of them because they're the first two new species of robot that's ever been, you know, like officially mass marketed. And it's just interesting to see that they people just didn't understand them. And I suddenly realized, okay, well, maybe I better go back to building things that people recognize. I know, I'll build a girl. And that's another one of my interesting motivations behind Femi. Of course, the other thing is I'm very pleased with is that she's just she's really just an incredibly sophisticated little android. One of the things I love, for example, is that you program her by just moving her in the way that you want. She remembers it and plays those motions back perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've ever done any computer programming, and especially things, you know, like the amount of computation required goes up exponentially with the number of motors involved. And so if you've got something like a remote control or a PC control, and we actually did this with the RS Media and the various other sort of robots I put out, Linux-based walking machines, you suddenly realize the complexity of getting them to do even basic things scares away an awful lot of people in this modern world where essentially we like quick, simple, elegant fixes. So a humanoid robot where you program it by just moving it in the way that essentially you want it to and it remembers it. I mean, that was just an elegance of interface that I was quite pleased worked as well as it did. And, of course, like the feedback we're getting is that young girls get it right away. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you like show her what to do, and she does exactly what you've just shown her. It's what's interesting is that, again, there it was. The technology is sophisticated, but it's completely hidden when you actually move it. Mm-hmm. One of the things, for example, we're quite pleased with the FemiSapien is an over 100-hour battery life. Now, that's something that's interesting for a humanoid. Modern robots, for example, you know, like you've got about 20 minutes at most before the battery completely dies. On FemiSapien, you can have her running nonstop between Christmas and New Year's and never have to worry about swapping out the regular batteries. Mm-hmm. That's significant, right? And that's, of course, based upon the regenerative aspect of biomorphic technologies. But the thing was is that it's just something that winds up letting people perform experiments and do plays with her that you would otherwise never be able to try with a conventional top-down complicated robot.
Mm-hmm. Speaking maybe a bit about what you were saying and what you're hoping that children take away from robotics, I know from a business point of view, of course, you want to interest girls in robots so that you sell more product and all that, but I'm sure there's an underlying kind of want to get children involved and maybe have some sort of effect on them so that they're interested in robotics when they grow up. What do you hope that children take away from the robots that you sell to them? Especially with a lot of adults right now, this fear in modern culture of robots taking over the world in terms of Matrix and all that. Do you have some sort of hope to dispel this or get people interested or something like that?
Exactly right. I mean, the fact was that Terminator phobia, as I call it, basically reached its peak back in the 1990s. The machines are coming. They're going to destroy us all. But as with most things, what you must find out is that if you actually play with a robot, what you'll find out is that it's, you know, they're still too dumb to basically have any plans against us. And the great thing about having a small, funny toy that basically has significant personality flaws means that you humanize it in a lot of ways. The bottom line is that I build robots that I would have killed for when I was a kid. In other words, it looks great. It does tons and tons of things. There are all kinds of secrets. And when I'm bored with it, I can open it up and there's all kinds of wonderful parts inside. One of the things that I basically am very proud of when I first came out here, and it's an industry-changing thing, is I came up with the standard BO5 and BO3 gearbox. That is that all of the gears and the motor in a beautiful little cheap, controllable gearbox that you can buy for, like, pennies. And there are 7 of them inside of RoboSapien. There are 5 inside of FemiSapien. All of my robots are based upon the standard module. So one robot basically has all the parts to build many other robots. And that basically winds up being something that I'm hoping we can wake up in children, and that is the sense of discovery. One of the interesting things about the toy industry is things like Lego and Meccano and other sort of build-it-from-scratch sort of toys, unfortunately, are really falling down. I mean, the modern consumer society basically wants everything prepackaged and ready to go. The interesting thing about all my robots is that they come out of the box ready and working. But the cool thing is that you can now take them apart with a single screwdriver, look at them, modify them, see how they work, and then put them back together. And this is something, of course, when I check out YouTube and I check out a lot of the other websites dedicated around my technology, is basically very encouraging for me. How do you just wake up that sense of scientific discovery? Something like where people will put down the laptop for a while just so they can basically figure out all the secrets that basically happens inside of a robot. And when I see people doing things like attaching flamethrowers to the mouth of my robot dragons, right? You know, I'm suddenly realizing, okay, somebody's getting the idea.
So as a last question before we finish, What do you see for the future of Huawei? Can you give us a little sneak peek of what you guys are coming up with? What are your next ideas, the next types of products, or what you'd like to see maybe in the next couple of years?
Well, unfortunately, I have to wear my business hat. And the businessman's hat, unfortunately, says more of the same. There are some new innovations that I'm coming out with. Femi Sapien's getting a brother, which is much as I can say.
nice.
Rather interesting little crack into voice recognition using simple analog control. That's as much as I can say. but it reduces the cost of conventional voice recognition by something like 1,000 times. And that basically makes it a lot more affordable. And if it gets it wrong, well, you'll forgive a stupid robot that gets it wrong for $10 than you will a GPS which gets it wrong for $5,000.
Mm-hmm, of course.
And that's something which we're working on. So again, what happens is that each one of my robots is a technology demonstrator for a new form of my analog control. What's been fun over the past while is suddenly realizing that we've been tackling all of these major issues, sight, vision, color recognition, radial retinas, advanced neurological and Markovian models for learning and stuff like that. This was interesting, putting out a toy that basically learns and nobody was interested. The RS Media, right? A walking, talking Linux box that you could program from a PC. Nobody was interested. People just want things that are prepackaged intelligence rather than the sort of incredible open-ended cradles into which they could put their artificial intelligence dreams. And so we give away as many of these robots as we can just to see if there's someone out there who might have an interest in really coming up with the minds that we could put into the cradles of these robot bodies. Huawei will be putting out an awful lot more flying stuff. Several years ago, I built a thing called a Blade Star, which was this little flying ceiling fan. Mm-hmm. And last year we sold just an incredible number of those, so there'll be a lot more innovative flying things. But these are not really robots. They're more like just little radio-controlled curios. In terms of advanced robotics, we're putting a lot of hopes right now on something called a Rovio, mm-hmm. which is a little mobile webcam which basically drives around under wireless control. So you can be here in Hong Kong and control this little roving webcam all the way over there in Zurich just through your cell phone. Now, that's interesting. It's not trying to clean. It's not trying to do anything robotic. It's just trying to basically give you the security of basically being able to check out your place from very far away. In terms of my own particular hopes and for the future of robotics, I'd like to see an awful lot more interest in people just building things. And it really encourages me when I start seeing things like the neuromorphic workshops, which are started by an awful lot of the fine people in Lausanne, and also things like the maker fairs that are now basically sprouting up all over the world, where people are basically saying, hey, look, I can do something simple and it's cool. And then they show to everybody, and all of a sudden it's generating more interest in people using their hands rather than just using their keyboards. The future of robotics, well, we've gotten some interesting prototypes here. I mean, I'm looking right now at my my 5-foot-tall walking humanoid from 4 or 5 years ago. It walked through the glass windows of the office next door, and unfortunately we had to take it apart, and it's just sat there in pieces ever since. The real problem is that who's going to buy a $1,000 full-size humanoid? The market just is not ready. And the thing is that we have the technology to make it possible, right? Now we just have to find out whether or not the market will allow us to do so. Technology demonstrators, I mean, what's so interesting is that you just get so used to having something on the shelf and seeing that people buy it because they want it and they like it. And then, of course, you start thinking about your own scientific dreams and you suddenly realize, well, there's got to be a way to get people to understand what the market should be. And this basically gets back to your previous question, which is the best way is to let people know that robots are not dangerous, that they mm-hmm. are lots of fun, and that what we can do is that we are actively working to try and simplify the interface so that you can get a robot to do something not just that you want it to do, but something that you'd like it to do, and do it, you know, with the sort of ease that will impress your girlfriend. That's hard. But once we approve it, all of a sudden it'll be something that'll wind up being the first mass-marketed super robot.
Great. Well, Mark, it was a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much for all your insights.
And okay, I'm sure... yeah. Well, Merry Christmas to everybody, right?
Yeah.
Go out there, buy my toys.
Don't worry, I'm sure they will.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
Adam and I were sitting at our office this week, and this big box arrives from Hong Kong. Of course, I'm used to him getting boxes and me not, because I'm a software person, whereas he makes hardware and has to order a bunch of parts. But then he opens the box, and there are these two Huawei Femi Sapiens sent by Tilden. He just couldn't resist, had to open one and boot it. Since then, the two are now inseparable.
As Sabine said, there are two of these cuties, and while mine is staying right here with me, you can win the second Femi Sapien by guessing what she did on her first weekend in Switzerland. Answers can be posted on our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum. Movies, drawings, and audio are encouraged to specify your guess. We'll be posting a video in our next episode to reveal the answer, and the winner, of course. And that's it for today's episode of Robots. With Christmas only a few days away, we have reviewed this year's robot novelties and compiled a list of our favorite robot Christmas presents, which you can find on our forum.
Okay, everyone, happy holidays. Thanks for listening, and hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Ho, 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 with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.